All right, here we go.
Hello, and welcome to the JuntoCast, a podcast on early American history. I'm Ken Owen, Associate Professor of History at the University of Illinois Springfield, and author of the book Political Community in Revolutionary Pennsylvania. This month on the podcast, we're going to be discussing political parties in early America, looking at their development in various North American colonies from about 1700 through political parties that formed during the Revolution, and then looking at the first party system that developed with the Federalists and the Democratic Republicans in the 1790s. Joining me in this discussion are Michael Hattam, an associate director of the Yale New Haven Teachers Institute and author of Past and Prologue, Politics and Memory in the American Revolution, which will be published by Yale University Press on November the 24th, and this is exciting news, is available for pre-order now on Amazon. Thanks for being here, Michael.
Thank you, Ken.
I'm also joined by Roy Rogers, who is a history teacher at the District of Columbia International School. Thanks for being here, Roy.
Howdy, Ken.
We're also particularly pleased this month to be joined by Lindsay Chavinsky. Lindsay is scholar in residence at the Institute for Thomas Paine Studies at Iona College, and senior fellow at the International Center for Jefferson Studies. She's also the author of the award-winning The Cabinet, George Washington and the Creation of an American Institution, which was published by Belknap Harvard University Press in April 2020. Thanks so much for being here, Lindsay.
Thanks so much for having me.
Parties have been a feature of the American political system from a very early stage, but they're often not tremendously well understood, at least in their early development. Partly, this is because the Founding Fathers spent a lot of time in their writings decrying the idea of political parties, even as they fostered and encouraged their development. So what we're hoping to do this month on the podcast is to take a long look at the development of political parties in early America, stretching from the colonial era through the American Revolution and into the early Republic. In our first section, we're going to talk about some early examples of parties, looking at a number of different colonies and examining the common themes of why parties developed in those colonies. And Michael, I know you had a few thoughts on this.
So if we're going to talk about the origins of political parties in colonial America, I think, you know, we need to go back to the 17th century England, late 17th century, to the origins of the Whig and Tory parties, really. These two parties emerged out of effectively the exclusion crisis in the late 1670s and early 1680s, where Parliament tried to legislate James II's exclusion from the throne. They were largely unsuccessful in doing that. But it was the Whig party that formed around this crisis that drove the Glorious Revolution of 1688. And that Whig party was the party of Parliament. It was the party of constitutional monarchy. It was a party that enjoyed support from merchants and promoted trade, while the Tories were originally the party of absolute monarchy. And there was just the party of the king, of the nobility, the landed gentry. And they were largely suspicious of promoting trade at the expense of landed wealth. And it's really after 1714 and the reign of Queen Anne that Whigs, under the leadership of Robert Walpole, held almost complete power in Britain during the reigns of George I and George II. And that's important because these party divisions informed colonial politics. So, for example, in many royal colonies, there were so-called court and country factions, with the court faction supporting the royal governor and council and the country faction supporting the colonial assembly. Now, they weren't yet parties like we'd think of them, but they clashed over issues having like paper money and land grants and things like that. But it's really not until the 1760s in New York City that we see something resembling modern parties when the sort of faction dynamic sort of solidified. And we see in 1768 and 69 two very contentious assembly elections that featured really the first sort of open campaigning, I think, with sort of outright appeals to the public, negative media about the other side's candidates and things of that nature, all of which had been seen as uncouth, really, politically uncouth until that time. So it's really not until, you know, just before the revolution, I think, that we begin to see, you know, something that really resembles our sort of modern conception of political parties.
But I think there's two things that we have to be aware of when we're thinking about the development of parties. And one of them, as you talk about, and rightly so, is that development of some sort of institutional basis for parties that exists outside of formal channels of government. And I know that that's a theme that we'll get back to later. But we can also look at political parties as groups that support and come together to support particular policies at election time and within some form of legislative assembly. And if we look at other colonies in North America, we can see the development of at least prototypical parties earlier in the period. If we look at the politics of Massachusetts, for example, we'll find, I think in the 1730s, policies developing around the issues of creating a land bank or creating greater access to paper money that spring up against the resistance of the governor and the governing council. If we look in Pennsylvania, there's often violent conflict at election time and election riots in the 1740s and 1750s. And a lot of that conflict begins to organise itself around the question of the governance of the Penn family, who are still in proprietary control of the colony, and a growing movement that develops that calls for the institution of royal government in Pennsylvania. I mean, one of the things that I think is notable, talking about all of these issues, is that we see that we're talking about Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, New York, and we could throw in Virginia here as well, and that in these areas where we see the development of political parties, we're seeing the largest populations and the more complex social structures developing. And it's perhaps not surprising then that the political parties that form in these colonies form themselves around either specific economic issues, specific cultural issues. Religion and the Great Awakening often causes political division as well, or political governmental issues. Often it's not much more than one of those issues that leads to the structuring of parties, and that's one of the reasons that they seem less formal, less instituted, and perhaps even less stable than the political parties that we're used to in the modern day. But nevertheless, that idea of inter-party competition, where particular labels mean something to partisans on both sides, I think is an important feature to note in colonial politics.
Yeah, I think one of the ways that you see that in the example that I gave, which was New York City's late 1760s assembly elections, is that, you know, we see references to one of the factions as being called the lawyer party, right, as opposed to the merchant party. There was before that, you know, the idea of the using that kind of label is really not common in New York City politics up until this time in the late 1760s.
And you'd find similar terms. The Quaker Party is well known for its supposed control of Pennsylvania politics, at least in the first half of the 1700s, and then the Royal Party developing later, of course, coming to its fullest fruition right at the outbreak of the Revolution, which makes it even the terminology even more confusing. But even then, we see that idea that people are developing shorthand labels with which to identify factions, even if they're not the most modern expression of political parties.
So in addition to the concept of factions around a certain occupation or religion or something like that, I think it's also really important that we recognize the people who we consider as political actors were a very small number of people in terms of the overall population. And so when we think about, you know, we say today politics is a very small world, and that was true times like a million at that point. And so the role of individuals is enormous. And so I know I'm jumping ahead a little bit here, and we'll get to this more later. But in Virginia, we see, you know, Patrick Henry sort of dominates a political party all by himself for a very long time. And the Clinton family in New York dominates a party for a very long time. And so the role of individuals and sort of that partisan identity as to who you affiliate with was also a really important component of "quote unquote" party politics.
Yeah, I mean, we see that in New York City in the 18th century. You know, the original sort of factional developments emerge around Lewis Morris and Governor Cosby, and that's in the 1730s. But by the 1760s, in the elections that I was talking about, they'd really organized around two family units, basically the Livingstons and the Delanceys. And so, you know, I think this is it's an excellent point that, you know, as the number of people who can participate in electoral politics is relatively small, it magnifies the importance or the influence of the individual or small groups.
And I think that also tells us something about the institutional context in which people operated as well, that if we look at the development of sophisticated politics in the 18th century, we generally see that through the rise of the colonial assembly, and in particular the importance of the speaker of the colonial assembly, who would often hold their position as speaker for 30 years or more. I'm thinking here particularly of David Lloyd in Pennsylvania, and that it's that sort of narrow control of a particular branch of the levers of power within a colonial government that leads to the development of factionalism, because power is concentrated in very few places in the colonial period, and therefore putting pressure on that one man or a handful of positions is critically important to gaining success for your broader policy.
Well, and even the act of voting itself was incredibly personal, because they didn't really use written ballots and the concept of anonymous voting wasn't a thing. And so you literally went to your polling place and cast your vote for the person, and they usually, both candidates were sitting in front of you. So there was no hiding who you sided with and what that personal relationship meant. And so I think that personal aspect of it, the very intimate aspect of it, the very public aspect of those alliances was central as well.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this in our episode on elections in early America, but this is something really important that I think that we're going to see change when we get to the 1790s, which is the sort of the beginning of the institutionalization of political parties, which. I mean, even though the first party system, each party has its sort of figurehead in Jefferson and Hamilton, there's a much more institutional feel and the beginnings of an institutional structure that begin to remove that really personal aspect of political partisanship, at least in the colonial period.
So one of the important things, I think, to understand some of the problems around parties in the colonial period, and I think this will also be true when we talk about the early republic, is defining what a party is. And we've sort of talked about this a little bit, but in the colonial period, there were in many ways, you know, factions that shifted back and forth and didn't have a deep institutional, consistent institutional expression, like we'll see towards the end of the early republic. And, you know, historians have been skeptical of calling that kind of political formation parties. I think there's been a move more recently to reorient that. I mean, I think one of the things that's really interesting is when I first came to graduate school in the mid-2000s to early 2010s, we were coming off an era that was much more skeptical of political parties in the 17th and 18th century. And you know, thinking that the first party system was not a system or a party, and that was something that was definitely inherited from understanding more about colonial politics. But I think since the late 90s and early 2000s, the literature has been building up now that we're starting to, I think, respect the political parties of the colonial era, and especially the political parties of the early republic as much more coherent, stable, and institutionalized political expressions than was, you know, very recently appreciated. And I think in some ways, the question of parties is a question made by historians more so than by the primary sources.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the problems I think there is that when we look at the founding era, people are very keen not to portray themselves as the tool of a party, but instead use the language of representing the people more broadly, even if their claims to represent the people are based off what we today might see as expressions of partisan or party support. And I think that one of the areas that we can look at this most productively is if we look at what's going on with regards to political parties before the Constitution. That on the one hand, you have a new polity, America, developing, where basically you are trying to get as much of the population behind support of America as possible. But yet, to go back to Carl Becker's famous formulation, this was as much a battle for who should rule at home as it was a battle for home rule. And that meant that there were divided loyalties come election time across the nation in the 1760s, 1770s, and 1780s. So perhaps this is a good time to reflect on that period of political contestation around independence and to ask, did parties really exist while America was prosecuting such active resistance to British rule?
I mean, so we have historically the use of these terms, Whigs and Tories, right, which come from the English history that I was talking about in our sort of introduction. I guess you could say it's a matter of interpretation whether you can think of the Whigs of the 1760s and 1770s or the Tories, you know, slash loyalists as a political party. I mean, they don't seem to have any sort of central, you know, institutional structure, really. Though, I mean, Ken might argue with me that the Continental Congress provides that type of institutional structure.
Yes and no. I mean, the challenge with the Continental Congress is that ultimately, with very few exceptions, if you're at the Continental Congress, you agree that Britain is doing wrong. And that means that the ability for sharp party divides becomes muffled somewhat. Mm-hmm. At the same time, the question of independence is a big one. But even then, we see the fluidity of representation in something like the Continental Congress, insofar as when it comes to the final vote for independence, important figures change their vote. And so there are certainly factions and divisions that operate on somewhat predictable lines, given what we know about the people that stood on either side of Congress. At the same time, the question to which they were ever directly mobilizing a broader population at election time, specifically for elections to Congress, is harder. And that's, of course, the institutional setting of Congress is something that was referred through the states. And so when we look at the individual states, some of them very clearly do have parties that are operating, and independence is a framing question. But because there are 13 different bodies that are sending people to the Continental Congress, that ability for party formation in the Congress is a little bit more complicated.
One of the, I think, key challenges with trying to identify political parties or political factions or even partisan ideology is the resistance that contemporaries at the time showed towards wanting to be seen as a political figure. And I know we've all talked a lot about political, or excuse me, Republican virtue and what it meant to be a Republican. And this is, of course, little r Republican, but to be a virtuous citizen and a virtuous public official meant that you weren't trying to seek that political position. And instead, you were called to duty. You were willing to sacrifice, whether it be financial opportunities or time with your family or time away from home. And you were doing it for the good of your fellow citizens and for the good of the nation, but you didn't necessarily want it. You didn't seek it out. You weren't eager to have it. And so in order to fulfill that image, even though they very rarely actually felt that way, because a lot of them were, you know, conniving and ambitious, and they absolutely wanted the power and the position, but to appear to not want those things, you had to appear to not be a part of a political party, because that was too base and that was too competitive and it was too prone to corruption and all of the bad things that they were trying to get away from by creating this virtuous Republican nation. And so a lot of that is posturing, but it also reflects a very real conviction that it, structural, institutionalized political parties would bring out the worst in people and not encourage the sort of virtuous behavior that was expected.
And that was particularly the case over the question of independence or prosecuting a war effort, because the minute that you push anything that looks like personal ambition into the question of declaring independence from Great Britain, it is much more easy to marginalise the claims that are being made about the necessity of making such a decisive break.
I mean, we're also talking about a quote-unquote enlightened era, right? And the idea being that the statesman, the enlightened statesman, would govern in a way that was based on the public good. But, you know, the idea of belonging to a party means that you have to toe that party line, whatever that is, right? And whether that's good or bad for the public good. And so this is another sort of limitation that was perceived on the part of parties, was that being a part of a party meant that a public official had in some ways their potential actions circumscribed, right, in a way that might not comport with the public good or the use of their own reason.
It won't surprise anyone who's listened to this podcast that I'm going to find some evidence to talk about Pennsylvania here. But I think this emphasises the importance of looking not just at a national, but also at a state level. And in Pennsylvania, from 1776 onwards, you see a particularly intense party battle that really does take on a lot of the institutional framework that we talk about when we talk about modern political parties. That is to say, this isn't just factions that are organised around recognisable leaders. And the battle comes down to questions of whether you accept the 1776 state constitution as legitimate, or whether you think that it stands in need of urgent revision. And from quite a remarkably early stage, we see organised party action of the sort that political theory would suggest shouldn't be possible. That is to say, representatives who are elected opposing the constitution refuse to turn up. They deny the legislature a quorum in the hope that this will be able to force both sides to come together to revise the state constitution. That leads to a referendum campaign. That leads in turn to a determined petition campaign in which both pro-constitution and anti-constitution parties are mobilising to show as much popular support as possible through representative mechanisms, either in support or against their political position. And by the 1780s, this turns from not just a battle over the institutional form of government, but leads to conflicts over measures like the composition of the College of Philadelphia. It leads to conflicts over the shareholders of the Bank of North America. And so we see that this division sort of morphs from being something where it structures debate over one particularly important issue to an area in which debates over several issues start to roll into this party divide, and it becomes increasingly predictable that if you describe yourself as a constitutionalist, you will be identified in support of three or four other policies as well. That's a development that we see particularly strongly in Pennsylvania, but we can also see developing to a lesser extent in other states prior to arriving at the Constitutional Convention.
I mean, we see it in the 1780s in the fights over the state constitutions, right? In Massachusetts, especially in Pennsylvania, states that left their state constitutions to, well, after independence or revised them afterwards, provided a sort of ideal cauldron, right, for the development of these types of party identifications. And that's something that is going to transfer to the national or federal scale, right, at the end of the decade.
And I think it's particularly important if we look at the Constitutional Convention itself and the way that ratification shapes up, that a lot of the delegations who were sent to Philadelphia in 1787, although they are sent as the representatives of their state, in reality, are the representatives of one faction of their state or one party within their state. And as a result, you see that these various different state parties that have developed for a multitude of reasons in the 1780s come in 1787 and in 1788 to be the natural pre-existing divisions around which supporters of the Constitution and opponents of the Constitution organize themselves. And that's where we see the genesis of the Federalists and Anti-Federalists becoming identifying labels in national politics. That it's, on the one hand, this is precipitated by the Philadelphia Convention and the need to ratify the Constitution, but at the same time, the political processes that have led to the Constitutional Convention also mean that this partisan structure is reflected in the way that Federalists and Anti-Federalists divide in that fall and winter.
I think that that's right, but I also think it's important to acknowledge that the sort of Federalist, Anti-Federalist divide takes on really peculiar shapes in each state. So you wouldn't necessarily think that ardent patriots like Patrick Henry and George Mason and James Madison would really disagree with each other about the Constitution. But there were a lot of sort of internal divisions there within the state. And then, as you mentioned, in Pennsylvania, of course, there is this big divide that kind of comes from the state constitution. But that divide isn't necessarily the same in, for example, Massachusetts. And so I think we do have to be a little bit careful when we're talking about sort of a national federalist, anti-federalist concept, that there definitely were sort of broad strokes up and down the continent, but each state took on its own particular baggage.
So I wonder from that, Lindsay, do you consider Federalists and Anti-Federalists to be political parties?
No, at least not in their early iteration. And maybe this is a very sort of skeptical view of parties like Roy was talking about. From my perspective, I think of Federalists and Anti-Federalists, at least in, you know, 1787, 1788, as sort of hodgepodge groups that have come together over sort of shared objections or shared strengths that they see in the Constitution. And so they are sort of temporary alliances to try and achieve a certain aim. And I think the Federalists in some ways were more successful at trying to achieve their aim at the very beginning, at least by, you know, naming themselves. I was revisiting the great Pauline Mayer and her work on the ratification process. And the concept of the Anti-Federalists being even just called that sort of demonstrates their lack of organization, because they couldn't come up with their own name fast enough. And because that sort of group of people that had worked together sort of splinter afterwards, once this main goal wasn't achieved, or I guess you could say it was in the sense that there was Bill of Rights, I don't really see that as a party institution like we've been talking about, even if it's just a nascent institution. I do think, however, it does sow the seeds for the later Democratic Republican Party.
It's interesting. I mean, about the nomenclature here. I mean, before the ratification conventions really sort of gained speed, a Federalist was someone who supported the Confederation set up, right? And it's really, really one of the strokes of partisan genius, I guess, on the part of those organizing the pro-Constitution cause that they adopted this name that basically meant the opposite of what it had meant up until that point. Right. And of course, the problem for the Anti-Federalists, because they did not claim that name when they probably should have, they had much less organization than the Federalist cause did. But of course, you know, it's never good politically when, you know, your primary sense of identification or purpose is anti anything, rather than being for something, right? And the Anti-Federalists certainly suffered from that.
I mean, I think that's one of the things that's really remarkable to anyone that starts to look at Anti-Federalism for the first time, is the fact that so many Anti-Federalists actually use the term federal when describing themselves. I'm thinking particularly here of the federal farmer, but we see the Anti-Federalist essayists are consistently using the terms. I mean, I think there, it's not even that they take the term federalist on the part of the Federalists. It's that they are so insistent and persistent and consistent in their usage that they manage to get it to stick, which is really quite a remarkable feat. Although I will add that that shows some of the other institutional benefits. As you guys know, I am often Democratic Republican to my very soul, and it would pain me not to mention the use and misuse of the newspaper editors and the post and the general postal system if we were talking about reasons for some of the failures of the Anti-Federalists in the ratification debate.
I mean, it's absolutely the case that the Federalists created a nascent infrastructure, right? Mm-hmm. Now, it wasn't necessarily a party infrastructure, but it became the seeds of a party infrastructure. But it was an infrastructure created for the sole purpose of achieving ratification.
Mm-hmm. I think you can extend that a little further, right? And you see it, I think, in the early Washington administration. I think that the Federalists were the closest of the two to being a political party. And mm-hmm. I think that some of those networks are drawn upon by the Washington administration. This is, I'm sure, something Lindsay can talk about more in detail, that I think is really important. I think if you follow Saul Cornell, while there is, I think, coherence to the Anti-Federalist position ideologically, and you can create like a taxonomy of it, I think that they come late to some of the more institutional expressions mm-hmm. that the Federalists start off early, right? I mean, we read the Federalist Papers, right, that we're forced to teach that, that primary source that it remains one of the most like talked about and used primary sources. And that just sort of speaks to the fact that Federalists were able to tap into these networks and really start to expand them. And then that infrastructure exists, and I do think gives them a head start in the Washington administration. And the Democratic Republicans, who are, disillusioned Federalists from James Madison to, Anti-Federalists, having to create that coalition during the Washington administration, they are a little late coming to it. But that's what I think one of the advantages that Washington has going into his first term is there's this proto, I think that's not even strong enough, this like infrastructure that they're able to build on. And you see Hamilton take advantage of it in the Treasury Department and Knox in the War Department. That's mm-hmm. a combination of the pre-existing Confederation institutions, but also this apparatus that was built to defend and promote the Constitution.
Well, I think there's also an ideological advantage, because if we think about the Federalists as a group of individuals who are sort of pushing for a more active, robust national government, and in particular, a more energetic executive branch, then once they're actually in office, they just continue that ideology through their sort of action and policy. Whereas the anti-federalists were sort of opposed to many of the provisions contained in the Constitution, but then the Constitution is passed. And so many of the people who had been opposed to this document then are elected into office. And so there is a little bit of an ideological disconnect in their having to figure out how they are going to relate to these new institutions that they had opposed not all that long ago. And so I do think that sort of basic ideological, they're sort of set back on their heels initially and had to figure out what it meant to operate within this system, accept the legitimacy of the system, and then find a way to sort of resist against what was the Washington administration agenda. And that just took a little while.
Yeah. I mean, even before the Washington administration, at the beginning, I should say, the very beginning of the Washington administration, I mean, the Bill of Rights is a product of anti-federalism,
mm-hmm.
right? I wonder, because this is directly in the realm of your recent book, I mean, George Washington is one of the most visible adherents to this older anti-party sort of Republican ideology. So how is it then that the parties emerge under his administrations?
Oh, it's the million-dollar question.
Why was he willing to go? Why do you think he was willing to go along with it rather than, just try to stamp it out?
Sure. Well, you're right that Washington absolutely saw himself as above party and not partaking in a descent into sort of partisan squabbling. But he did see it happening, and perhaps he was a little late to realizing what was going on. Both Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, who were sort of the emerging leaders of these two factions initially, were complaining about the other incessantly. And he was sort of ignoring those complaints for a long time or pushing back on them, or he worked really hard to try and convince Hamilton that Jefferson was a good patriot and vice versa, obviously with very limited success. So he did his very best to try and sort of limit the effect of that partisan spirit within his own administration. But there were a lot of times where it was a very badly kept secret that Jefferson was essentially funneling cabinet secrets to James Madison or drafting resolutions to condemn Hamilton in the House of Representatives. And everyone knew that Jefferson was the author. So it was like this terrible secret that the Secretary of State was trying to undermine the Secretary of Treasury. And I don't really know why he didn't do anything more clear to stop that. He, of course, one of the great frustrations is he often didn't write down what he was thinking. So we don't really know what sort of the thought process was. My best guess, my best speculation is he thought if he continued to set an example of what it meant to try not to engage in that partisan spirit, then eventually people would come around. Or if he went after that party spirit more strongly in his own administration, then it would make it worse. And so I think he kind of tried to keep them together. Obviously, that didn't work. And their conflict was rooted in a deeply antagonistic view of what the nation should be. They disagreed on everything from who should be sort of the favored citizens to which nation should be the closest ally to how the nation should invest in infrastructure or technology. I mean, you name it, they disagreed about it. And so there just was no way to keep those two people sort of on the same path and working towards the same goal. But he certainly could have done more. And that's a really unsatisfying answer.
I mean, to follow up on Washington, I wonder if, I mean, well, because he had been very effective at sort of modeling Republican virtue as mm-hmm. commander in chief, right, of the Continental Army.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if he sort of just expected that would work again, that would continue to work. And the other question I have is, do you think that he was fully aware of the sort of the building up of the infrastructure of the parties that was occurring on a state level, like throughout the Republic and early in his administration? Do you think he was aware of that, or was part of his response, do you think that maybe he could still, modeling his virtue, could still be successful because he was unaware of just how developed the parties were becoming on the state level?
Yeah, I mean, so to take your first question, I think the difference between the war and his presidency is really the difference between military and civilian command, because when he was commander in chief, there were certainly people who questioned his decision making, especially in Congress. He didn't always get along with all of his generals, but by and large, his soldiers and his subordinate officers adored him, just adored him. And there was a very strict hierarchy that was not really replicated and frankly would not be appropriate in a Republican civilian government. And so that sort of virtuous command was not really possible in the presidency because you didn't have such a strict hierarchy. I also think that there were frankly sort of different stakes because the country was so distrusting of the military that no form of partisan conflict could really be tolerated because there was so much distrust for the military institution. Whereas once you're in government and they were operating as civilians and they were no longer in military uniform, I think some of those guardrails start to come down a little bit. Then in terms of the second question, he definitely knew some of what was going on. So, you know, of course, the famous example of Jefferson hiring Freneau to start the newspaper that was going to be the pushback to Hamilton's newspaper and putting Freneau on the State Department payrolls as a translator. But Freneau could only speak French, and obviously Jefferson needed no assistance in translating that particular language. At one point, Washington sort of calls him on it, but doesn't force him to fire Freneau, which is a very strange conversation that Jefferson actually took notes on, of that, you know, Washington was clearly displeased, but didn't ever insist that Jefferson get rid of him. And he definitely knew about the Democratic-Republican societies that were starting to crop up because he complained about them all the time in cabinet meetings and blamed them for instigating the rebellion in 1794 over the whiskey excise tax. But I think that he thought that they were sort of these radical partisan organizations that were instigated by perhaps radical, dangerous French immigrants and didn't really understand that they actually were supported by a large portion of the population and had tangible institution and the beginnings of an infrastructure that would turn into a party.
I think also when thinking about Washington, we have to think of, where he ended up in partisanship at the end of his life, mm-hmm. like maybe the last 2 years of his presidency and certainly his post-presidential career. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, him complaining about those Democratic-Republican societies later become, I think in his final years, he had somewhat come to terms with partisanship because I think he was sick of the criticism where he felt he was trying to act in this good Republican way that had worked so well for him in the army. And he truly did believe. But I think he was exhausted. He felt mm-hmm. that his policies were being disrespected, and he did truly believe that they were the best ones for the country. And he was much more at peace with partisanship, I think, when he turned the keys over to Adams. And then when you see his actions in the Adams administration, his willing to take that army command, his willingness and his insistence that Hamilton be promoted as his, you know, basically doing all the hard work. Mm-hmm. And Hamilton was so clearly a partisan figure by that point. I think, you know, everybody knew that from Washington, you know, down to, you know, locals at every level of government and, you know, his private correspondence, right? I think mm-hmm. Francois Furstenberg's book, In the Name of the Father, just goes into this, I think, really convincingly. I think he's a much more committed Federalist when he dies than he was, you know, through most of his presidency. And I think that's a really important, I think, thing to remember about the party system. I think it is really built up by the end of the Washington administration. I think most of that Republican virtue becomes performative, and that most of the actors really are, I think, in good faith, believing that their political actions are what's best for the Republic. And the only way to do that is through partisanship. And it could be negative partisanship, where I think Washington kind of ended up, or more positive partisanship, where the Jeffersonians were moving in the last years of the 18th century.
Well, and I think there's one component of that I want to address, which was that he felt like he had sacrificed for so many years and he had served for so many years. And rather than being appreciated and sort of celebrated and cherished as this person, he was criticized, especially by the Democratic Republicans. And so he got really bitter about that. And he didn't, he always, of course, had a very thin skin, but he got especially bitter about that towards the end. And I think that's kind of where one of the motivating factors, as Roy said, for this increased acceptance of the Federalists, because he felt like they understood all that he had sacrificed and they appreciated what he had done. And so he was really angry that the Democratic Republicans were criticizing him because he felt that that was perhaps undeserved and unfair and very ungrateful.
So I fear that I might be coming in as sort of the David Bradford from Western Pennsylvania, hot-headed Democratic Society member. But we're being very nice about Washington and the Federalists here in terms of...
I just called him bitter.
I mean in terms of the development of the party system. And actually, I think this is something that comes out of the literature as well. This is quite a long-standing theme, that if we look at the development of the party system with capital P, capital S, it's often seen as, especially Jefferson, taking these particularly self-serving measures of hiring Freneau, of using Madison, of using John Beckley as well as a party organizer at election times, and that we see that a lot of these Democratic Republican oppositional institutions as sort of being deliberately precipitated and fermented as oppositional bodies that provide the infrastructure of the parties. But I think in the same way that Brian Ballow talks about Hamilton wanting to create a government out of sight, I think sometimes we underestimate the extent to which Hamilton in particular being in government allows Hamilton to create a party out of sight, in that he is able to do a lot of quite partisan actions under the cover of either following Washington's instructions or doing what's necessary to establish a functioning treasury system. And so things that are partisan actions that Hamilton is doing, because let's face it, Hamilton knows full well exactly how controversial his national bank plan is going to be. He knows how the assumption of state debts is going to go down. He knows that in having his own pocket senators to introduce his reports and his legislation, that he has the ability to pull on certain levers of power because he has pre-assumed loyalties and people working in concert with him. All of those seem to me to be quasi-party actions. The thing is that I think we need to understand that one of the ways that the Federalist Party becomes a party is that it takes its ideology as the administration of a Republican government, and that that means it's harder for us to point in the modern era, where we're used to two-party systems that exist outside of the infrastructure of government, and each party brings their own guys in when they win an election. And actually, I think if we looked at some comparisons to parliamentary systems and to parties in other countries, we might actually see some quite useful comparisons with the way that the Federalists operate as a party. Which is of course not at all to say that there isn't a lot that to be gained by looking at the way that Washington and others disdain party rhetoric, but on the other hand, they're also doing a lot behind the scenes, and that mixture between governmental action and popular mobilization. The Democratic Republicans have to be on the side of popular mobilization because they're not in government. But that makes them look much more like a modern political party than what the Federalists have to do, because they have certain inbuilt advantages in their organization.
Gautam Rao's book, National Duties, does a really great job of exploring how Hamilton uses the built-in advantages of the Treasury Department to build out this infrastructure for state building, of course, but also for sort of the political networking that you were talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it doubles back to our earlier point that I think the Federalists have that, they inherited that apparatus that was still working up to the point in which Washington was inaugurated, right, to defend and promote the Constitution. And Hamilton's able to take advantage of that. And in many ways, the reason why it's so easy to point to Jeffersonian actions, right, is that the Federalists, particularly Hamilton, they have the initiative, right? They have the political initiative in the early Washington administration. Many of the important
Jefferson is also an easy target.
Yes, he's an easy target. But like, just think about someone who is going to be important to the Democratic Republicans, like James Madison, right? He's still, like, initially a little bit of a fence sitter, right? He doesn't fully appreciate, like, what Hamilton is going to do. Mm-hmm. And hasn't broken with Hamilton, right? They had been friends and political colleagues very recently. And so, like, but once it's the scope of this sort of partisanship in disguise, to use, you know, is made clear to him, he's got to move. And that just takes time, right? That takes political time to move these people and activate these people, right? To use a modern political term, right? You have these constituencies that need to be activated. They used to be supporters of federalism, but now they need to be activated as Democratic Republicans because they weren't anti-federalists. Yeah. And that's a process that's going to take time. And it's so much easier to track in the primary sources when Hamilton, Knox, Washington have the cover of setting up the government to cover their own partisan actions, because, as you know, setting up the government is, you know, a partisan action to the Federalists because that's their ideology. So I think it is important to note that tension there.
Yeah, it's a huge advantage that in some sense has to do with timing, right? I mean, there are, in my own research, working on history, culture in this period, I've found lots of examples of, you know, individuals who were Federalists in the late 1780s, early 1790s, sort of by default, right? Because they were supporters of the Constitution, of ratification of the Constitution. And so by default, they were supporters of the Washington administration, sort of, you know, before the party system fully emerged. And yet, you know, there are lots of examples of individuals who effectively supported Washington and supported the Federalists in the early 1790s, but by the end of the decade declared themselves to be Democratic Republicans.
And it becomes a challenge, actually, by the time you get to the end of the 1790s, because so much has been built around the government, that it means that as the Democratic Republican oppositional apparatus becomes a lot more developed and sophisticated, any splits that emerge in the government become much weaker points than they have been previously. You know, it's easy to marginalize Jefferson as someone that wasn't really acting in the best interests of the nation. But when it's Adams' cabinet, where there's much more open splits about what's going on, and they're meeting with a much more sophisticated opposition, the combination of governmental apparatus with party apparatus becomes a much harder square to circle.
Yeah, I mean, this you know, when we did an episode on the election of 1800, and we had talked about, you know, the importance of that election resulting in the first sort of peaceful transfer of power. But you know, one of the ideas I think that's important for American political culture generally going forward is by the end of the 1790s, the acceptance of the idea that there can be such a thing as a legitimate opposition.
Yeah, I think the Adams cabinet presents a really interesting breaking point for the first political parties as they're beginning to develop, because the people that Adams kept from Washington's sort of second round of cabinet secretaries were very much high Federalists, super ardent Hamiltonians, and really sort of took their orders from the leaders of the Federalist Party, either in Congress or outside of the administration, like Alexander Hamilton. Whereas Adams was still sort of operating under this non-Federalist political party concept. I mean, he definitely saw himself as a Federalist, but he did not adhere to a party loyalty in the way that people came to do. And so there was real conflict within the administration that I think at times probably bordered on treason, which makes for a very good story, but didn't make for very good political party, you know, loyalty. And what really undermined the Federalists' ability to win elections and act as a coherent party structure. And so I think that does definitely facilitate the decline of the Federalist power, especially in the administration, and accelerates the rise of the Democratic Republicans or the Jeffersonian Republicans or the Republicans, depending on which version of that you want to call them at this point. So I do think it's a really good point that sort of marks this transition in these two different political parties. And I do sort of wonder, as an interesting hypothetical, if Adams' administration had been able to sort of march in tandem together and operate as a really well-oiled political unit, if we would have seen the decline of the Federalist Party in the way that we did.
Well, I think one of the most impressive things about the last 2 years of the Washington administration into the Adams administration, and particularly the dark days of the quasi-war, is that the Jeffersonians were able to hold their coalition together pretty well, which I think is actually one of the reasons why they were able to have such success. And the fact that they were able to weather Burr's betrayal in 1800 and is, I think, also a really good sign for why the Federalists were not able to build the infrastructure that allowed them to survive. And I think that might have to do with, I think, weirdly, the cult of personality was stronger in the Federalist Party than the Jeffersonian Party, even though we think about it and tie it so close to Jefferson. I think that, you know, the need for Washington to act as a unifying figure that all Federalists could project themselves and their beliefs on was really important. And then when he dies, you have Adams and you have Hamilton, and they're both very divisive figures for each side's faction. And they're not able to achieve unity because there's no one that's able to do that. And Jefferson's able to hold that role together while also not making it entirely about him, which I think is really important for where the Jeffersonians go and the fact that they're able to establish the era of good feelings after 1800 and smash the Federalist Party, or the Federalist Party smashes itself, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I mean, building off of that point, I think both the Federalist Party and the Republicans, definitely these were not, you know, democratic institutions. They were very elitist, and they felt like, you know, only the most wealthy and the best of the best should be serving. But the Republican Party had the good sense not to really say that out loud and to be solicitous of some of the lower classes and other white men that maybe didn't have quite as much property. And so it didn't become all about these great men that were sort of deigning to serve. Whereas the Federalist Party, you know, they very much thought that the elite needed to lead society and didn't really do a good job of demonstrating how that was going to be beneficial. And so I know we're not really going to go into the rise of sort of the second party system and the era of good feelings as much, but I do think that sort of precedes this growth of democratization and the expansion of white suffrage. Is there was this concept that leaders needed to be solicitous of the people they were supposed to lead, and that was something that, for better or for worse, Federalists just didn't ever really accept.
And I think one other failure, and I agree completely. I think that's a really important point about the success of the Democratic Republicans under Jefferson. I think it's also notable just how narrow a lot of the Federalist opposition ended up seeming to be, in that opposing the Louisiana Purchase seemed to have a very restrictive view of what American development might look like. I mean, the Federalists made a very tight logical argument against the Louisiana Purchase, but it didn't have the benefits of the expansiveness with which Hamilton talked about the National Bank, for example. Similarly, when thinking about how to deal with Britain and France and the impressment of sailors, it seemed like the Federalists were willing to negotiate on points of national honour, that their oppositional machine didn't have the same level of national vision that Washington and Hamilton were able to talk about when mm-hmm. they were establishing government. And I think we see a very clear tonal difference in Federalist opposition compared to Democratic-Republican opposition in the 1790s.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Before we conclude our discussion on political parties, I just want to go around the room and ask for our main takeaway from the discussion that we've had today. And I thought what we could do here is to make one point about the importance of studying and understanding political parties, and also giving one book to recommend for our listeners if they wanted to pick up any further reading on the topic. So, Michael, can you give us one takeaway and one book recommendation?
Sure. I think in terms of takeaways, I think it's important to take away from this discussion, generally speaking, that party structures are not preordained, right? And they're not permanent. And I think that that's a really important takeaway that is usefully applicable to thinking about politics in a contemporary perspective. In terms of book recommendations, I would recommend, for our earlier discussion talking about the colonial period, Patricia Bonamy's Factious People, which is about the early development of political factions and parties in colonial New York City. And I would also recommend, I think, for the 1790s, for what we've been talking about, James Roger Sharp's book, American Politics in the Early Republic, I think is the title, which is basically, generally, it has an argument, but it's a fairly good overview of the real inflection points of the politics of the 1790s.
Lindsay, how about your takeaways and book recommendations?
Well, I'm still kind of blown away by your point about the lack of Federalist vision once they lost the presidency. And I hadn't really thought about that, but I'm working on a new project on Adams and Jefferson, and that's really going to stick with me. So I'm going to ponder that for a while, because you wouldn't necessarily think that the party of, you know, big government was going to be the party of little imagination, but that's a really interesting point.
They get the anti-federalist problem.
Yes, exactly, which is just really fascinating. So that's going to be on my mind. In terms of books, I kind of want to cheat and say a lot. So I mentioned earlier Pauline Mayer, Ratification, which is, you know, essential to any reading on, I think, the 1780s, and it just blows my mind every time I revisit it. She's also really funny, so it's a very entertaining book. The second one I would say is The Second Creation by Jonathan Gnapp, who, it's a really amazing book about the first couple of sessions of the Federal Congress, and the machinations and additional development of what the state was going to be. And it shows some of these themes that we talked about the anti-federalists figuring out how they were going to play a role in the new system. It shows Madison's sort of transition and development, and just a really, really smart book that I think emphasizes that the government and the political structure and political culture was not done once the Constitution was ratified. There was this ongoing process. And so that's a really great selection. Oh, I'm going to cheat. Can I do a third book? The last thing I would say would be The First Presidential Contest by Jeff Pasley, which does a great job of showing actually how much political structure and party structure there was in 1796.
Am I going to have to have an ex post facto veto? You stole my book.
Sorry. You can cut it out if you want. You can cut it out.
Roy, how about your takeaways and recommendations?
So my takeaway is, I think the biggest part of the discussion to me, I think, was the interesting tension about how the first party system was built. And I think that for people thinking about partisanship, particularly partisanship when it involves government and government action and initiative, really, I think, thinking about Hamilton and building the government, not just as state building as it's traditionally thought about, discussed and debated, but also that it's an act of partisanship is really important takeaway. But and also the fact that the Jeffersonian Republican Party was also about, again, to use a modern term, activating these different types of voters who didn't necessarily going into the Washington administration weren't natural political allies, but would be through their opposition to once Washington begins putting his policies and Hamilton's policies and Knox's policies into place, I think is really important. Thinking about both, I think, the 1780s and kind of also our modern period, because I think one of the traps that people frequently fall into in politics is projecting their beliefs on big figures like Washington. And then, of course, eventually political leadership is about making choices. And once people start making those choices, it's very easy to move into opposition and become disillusioned with someone that you used to really admire. And I think that's important to the story of the late 1780s, early 1790s. Follow up about that, about Washington and sort of later Washington that we discussed about, I definitely think that Francois Furstenberg's In the Name of the Father, I think is really useful for thinking about Washington as an image, and particularly Washington as a partisan image. His chapter about Washington as partisan and talks about the end of his life, I think is really important to thinking about the late 1790s and where the Federalist Party ends up and what could have been if Washington had lived, you know, to see the election of 1800, things might have been different. I think it's important to think about that. And I can't go away without recommending David's book, David Wallstreicher's In the Midst of Perpetual Fits. If you, our academic audience has almost certainly read that book, but it, for those folks who haven't gone through graduate school or high-level undergrad classes in the early Republic, it's definitely a really important re-examination of how political culture and political parties worked in the late 18th and early 19th century that I think still resonates today, even though the book's coming up on several decades since it's been published.
And for my part, my two takeaways are these. First, we shouldn't take the founders at their word when they claim to be skeptical or worried about the existence of political parties. I think it's really important if we're going to properly understand the nature of political contestation at America's founding, that we look at the various different ways that party thinking and party organization shaped the political culture and the political development of the early Republic. The second thing I'd say, and this is an important theme of my own work, is that parties are conduits between the government and the people. And my book is about various different institutions that acted as those conduits between the government and the people. But that it's very easy for us to look at political parties just from the point of view of their expressions of popular politics or of popular mobilisation, and that we need to remember that parties exist because they are designed to either run government or to bring pressure and meaningful change on government, and that remembering that parties exist as institutions that act as a bridge between what might otherwise be two groups in the government and the people that might have separate interests, I think is really important for understanding the nature of democracy. As far as book recommendations go, I think I would recommend Saul Cornell's The Other Founders, which looks at the anti-federalists in American politics from 1788 through to 1828. And it tells you a lot about the complexity of looking at oppositional thought when it's not directly structured into party forms. And it's a good introduction into the ways that parties help us understand politics, but also how easily party activity can be obscured. And I would second Lindsay's recommendation of Jeff Pasley's The First Presidential Contest, which I think has been really important for taking the language of parties in the 1790s seriously again. Clearly, our discussion here shows that we've all got a great amount of sympathy with looking at parties as important institutions in American history. But I think that is a very good and very thorough overview of how party labels came to be so meaningful in the early Republic. So that brings us to the end of the discussion today. Before I give you more information about how to find out more about the Junto cast and to get in contact with us, I did want to talk to Lindsay briefly about her podcasting activities, because you've just started podcasting for the... I will start that again, because I just had ITPS in my notes and I've forgotten exactly what it is. Institute for Paine, Thomas Paine Studies. Okay. Because I know that you've just started podcasting for the Institute for Thomas Paine Studies, would you be willing to tell us a little bit more about the podcasts that you're doing there?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for asking. So apparently 2020 is the year of the podcast. And so I'm actually working on a couple of different projects. The first is with the Institute for Thomas Paine Studies. And we kicked off our partnership by doing a three-part mini-series on the dual pandemics of COVID-19 and structural racism and their impact on education and cultural and historic sites. And then that is going to transition into a year-long series on public history and how all different types of practitioners are grappling with the virtual world that we are currently living in. So you can find those podcasts under the Institute for Thomas Paine Studies podcast in your apps. The mini series was called Public Health, Public History. And then the long series is going to be called Public History in a Virtual Age. But all of those are under the umbrella of the Institute for Thomas Paine Studies podcast. And then the second project, this is the first time I've actually talked about it. It will be launching in October, is with the Center for Presidential History. And we are examining the very complicated history of presidents and race from Abraham Lincoln to Donald Trump. So starting in October, we will have an episode about each president and we'll be exploring and interviewing experts about that. And so that will be called The Past, The Promise, The Presidency, and will also be available wherever you like to find your podcasts.
Will you be doing those chronologically, and will they all be released at the same time?
Great question. They will be done chronologically. They will not be released at the same time because I am a little bit of a masochist, but not that much of a masochist. And so they will be released once a week. We're going to drop the first two, Lincoln and Johnson, on October 1st, and then they will be once a week after that.
Fantastic. So there's something else to look out for in your podcast feed. The JuntoCast is also available in all of your favorite podcast feeds, but we have a particular request for you this month, which is that if you want more people to find out about the JuntoCast, it would help us if you could find us in the iTunes store and leave a positive rating and a kind review. We also have a website, thejuntocast.com, and you can find us on Twitter using the handle @JuntoCast. If you're particularly adventurous, you can also search for our Facebook page by searching for The JuntoCast. That's all we've got time for this month, which leaves me to thank Michael Hatton.
Thank you, Ken.
Roy Rogers.
Thanks, Ken.
And Lindsay Chavinsky.
Thanks, Ken.
And thank you to you all for listening. We hope you'll join us for the next episode.
All right, here we go.
You can visit our website. What's our website address again?
TheJuntoCast.com.
And we're particularly pleased to be joined this week by Lindsay Chavinsky.
Up, up, up. This month.
Thank you, Michael. Now I know how one of Michael's children feels.
Also, I'm sorry. I barely stopped laughing after you said the available for pre-order now on Amazon. Like, I almost was like, I'd just be laughing when Ken calls on me.
I really wanted to like say like whoop whoop, but I thought that might not be welcome.
I was gonna do that too.